Welcome to Out of Bounds. I am not Tish Perlman. My name is Barbara Mink, and I am an FOT, friend of Tish. And we're going to talk today on our last, I use the word the proprietary hour, on our last show together, trying to reverse the roles and maybe give loyal listeners over the last 15, count them, 15 years, a sense of who the person behind the mic is. The show's been going for 15 years, and Tish and I met around 2000, and we were the same and yet different people. I was in the county legislature, and Tish worked at my former radio station, WHCU, and I have very vivid memories of sitting in Simeon's over, how can I say, a cocktail, and talking about life and politics. And Tish had much more of an activist background than I did. I was trying to play it down the middle as a legislator and a former journalist. And that was an interesting time of change because 1 year later, I decided not to run for the board. And 3 years later, Tish brought to fruition something we had talked about at those meetings, which was a talk show. Not a call-in talk show, not a reality show, but an intelligent discussion. And that's what we've all enjoyed these last few years. So, without further ado.
Thank you, Barbara. It's nice to see you spend our last moments with
you. Yes, yes. I've been lucky enough to be on the show a few times for different things. And you're keeping track of the cultural and artistic life in this community has been both current and forward-looking. Tell me a little bit, before we get into your origin story, which I know people do want to hear a little bit about, tell me first why you decided to confine the show to culture, art, and so on, as opposed to politics, which was so much a part of your background.
Yeah, well, art has always been a part of my background, too. I'm a poet, as many people know, and did theater for a long time. I just thought that people wanted to be entertained more than getting into political fights. And I kept thinking it's going to be political fights if I do a political show. Mm. And everybody's going to be vying to want to be on, who's mm-hmm. running for office. And I didn't want to get involved with that kind of fight and that kind of territory where people are at each other's throats often mm-hmm. and wanting equal time. And
if you were starting the show in 2016, would you feel differently?
I don't know. I was real worried about 2016 because I didn't want to get caught in the fray, and I didn't want to get my show caught in the fray. And
yeah, it feels almost like a responsibility to have discussions because they're so hard to have, even in normal life.
You're talking about political discussions?
Yes, yes. Sorry, 2016 for me is a watershed moment.
Yeah. Oh, God, it was.
But on the other hand, it was a relief to be able to listen to an author or a writer or a painter or something.
And
I
figured people are still making art while this politics was going on, mm-hmm. while this upheaval, this cultural change was happening mm-hmm. in our country. And mm-hmm. and people were still wanting to make art and focus on beautiful things and focus on the spirit and the souls of themselves and their worlds.
That's right. And I remember we talked about that many times over the years. How can one continue to do art? I remember you were an integral part of the early discussions of the Light and Winter Festival when it first started that in 2004, which is pretty close to when Out of Bounds started.
Yes.
And the issue of the difference between didactic, politically framed art and art for art's sake is a very fruitful topic. And I know, speaking just for myself as an artist, and I would like to know what you think about this, it feels imperative to continue to do art, not only as an escape, but as a validation of humanity and the spirit and so on.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And, you know, that's what I was afraid of. That's what I wanted to mostly focus on, the spirit of the artist, mm-hmm. because that encompasses the spirit of the culture in many ways. Mm-hmm. So I wanted people to be able to take a look at that aspect of themselves instead of the political fights and the nitty-gritty and the everyday issues that are constantly on people's minds, of course. The art is where we deliver our souls to each other, I think.
That's a nice phrase. People like us, you were in the trenches agitating and working as an activist in San Francisco. I was in politics and journalism, and so it was a very different path. But your use of the phrase nitty-gritty or day-to-day is what a lot of people who aren't so involved don't understand, that it can be an all-consuming, constant, minutia-filled activity.
Yeah, so you're talking about politics. Mm. Absolutely. And I was involved in politics in San Luis Obispo and San Francisco. And I mainly was starting organizations at that time. That was in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I helped to start a Gay and Lesbian Alliance and a Now chapter.
This was in San Luis Obispo.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I started out not doing electoral politics, which I did finally venture into. Mm-hmm. But starting organizations to help people's lives, to give people a home, to give people kind of an identity in which they are encouraged mm-hmm. to be themselves, mm-hmm. especially the LGBT organizations that I was part of. So that was my main focus. But, you know, even those peaceful thoughts of creating an organization and a community and a family, it was fraught with all kinds of politics.
And creation in general.
Mixed messages and people thinking that people were intruding who shouldn't be there, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it's been an incredible education, and I still love politics.
Yeah. What took you from San Luis Obispo to San Francisco?
I wanted to get involved more in politics, and especially LGBT politics.
You worked with She Who Rules Us All, right?
I worked in Nancy Pelosi's first campaign.
Right.
I did, and that was in, I think, 1986, because she was the chair of the Democratic Committee.
She was the minority chair.
And a big shot in San Francisco, right?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I got involved with her campaign, and it was so exciting, and people were so mad at me because she ran against a gay man who I knew, Harry Barrett, and I just didn't think he had the right personality. He was great as somebody on Common Council, but I could not think of him in the fray nationally.
Mm-hmm.
So I got involved with Nancy's campaign, and a lot of people were really angry at me, but you know, all along I felt like it was the right decision, even if we had lost.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, okay, this is, we need to expand out. The life we are living is not in a box.
Right. You know? Yeah. So you were very involved in politics up there. And what brought you and your partner, Carol, to Ithaca?
Well, Carol was originally from this area. She was born in Corning area and went to Elmira College. And she went to California with her first husband and stayed there forever almost.
Ah.
We were in San Francisco during the last days before the dot-com revolution and the big money started pouring in. We left at the end of 1999. I loved being involved in politics, but I really, really wanted to get away from the big money and the influx of people taking over the neighborhoods just because they had money, didn't care about the history, didn't care about what had been built in many ways. At least that's how I felt.
Right.
So I thought, I've never lived in the seasons. I was born and raised in Southern California.
My mother said it's good for the soul.
It is. Yeah. So I thought, okay, Carol, are you ready to go? I'm ready to go.
Wow.
And we were ready to go, and here we are, almost 20 years later.
Well, at some point you lived for a while in the Netherlands. When was that?
That was 1990 till 1993, I believe.
Oh.
Yeah.
What took you there?
Well, I had been to Europe a couple times before that, and I thought, ooh, the Netherlands is where I felt at home. I'm part Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather's name was Vandervoort, so that's quite
Dutch. Than that.
Yeah, I know. So I wanted to go back to Amsterdam and the Netherlands because I was going alone. I went there by myself, and I thought, okay, I can feel at home there. I really felt like I could. I got to know some Dutch people before that and stayed in touch with the country, as I do when I get interested in different places. So I decided, okay, I'm leaving. I want to leave San Francisco right now, and I want to go do something. And I was working on a play at the time.
Writing a play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about my family. And I just said, okay, I'm going. And people were really kind of freaked out that I was doing that, going.
Did you know
myself.
You were going to go for so long?
Nope.
Yeah.
I was just going to go for a few months, I thought. And then I started meeting people and the people inviting me to stay at their places and offering me apartments and friendship and meals. And, God, it was just one of those places where you're at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, exactly.
And you just meet people that you gel with. It was absolutely incredible experience.
What made you leave?
I got homesick.
Mm-hmm.
I got homesick, and I was a
the language or the culture.
Language. I was able to speak a little Dutch and understand a
little
Dutch.
It's never the same, though. Yeah.
But it's not. And the people in the Netherlands, I don't bother, you know, because everybody speaks English.
Right.
So I got homesick, and I wanted to come back.
Mm-hmm. So you came to Ithaca and immediately went to HCU, or?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I worked at Borealis Bookstore first for about 6 months. Uh-huh. Yeah, that was my first venture. I had bookstore experience. I worked at a different light bookstore in San Francisco. Uh-huh. I don't know if anybody knows that one, but it's a very famous gay bookstore. Uh-huh. And I worked at the Depot Bookstore up in Marin County, and great way to meet people, by the way.
So. I'm laughing at this because my husband, Jack, had owned the Bookery Bookstore for about 45 years, which is now closing,
yes.
like the show.
Yes,
and
yes.
He was sat in a fishbowl, and everybody would come by, and it's a kind of a nice way to get into a community.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. It is. So it's, you know, I mean, and then I started applying for jobs at WHCU and mm-hmm. different places because I wanted to go back into broadcasting. I was doing a lot
you
of
did.
Broadcasting.
Okay. Yeah.
Before that, I worked at KPFA in Berkeley. And mm-hmm. So I was doing broadcasting, some voiceover work, putting news stories together for radio. And so I thought, oh, I'll never be able to do that here in this small town. And I was amazed that I got hired mm-hmm. at WHCU within mm-hmm. in the probably the first 4 months.
Yeah, I was at HCU from 78 to 86.
Yes.
And I left when it changed hands, when Cornell offloaded both stations, which is a shame.
Yeah.
So it must have been a very different place when you were there.
I think, in some ways, WHCU felt more like a commercial station that I had been at
right.
before,
right.
you know, that was mainly rock music or something.
Mm-hmm.
This had talk, at least.
Mm-hmm.
But it did feel very much like a commercial mm-hmm. station. A lot of the stations that I have been a part of have not really cared that much about the local work.
Mm.
They're more into getting the, for instance, NPR shows.
Yes, yes.
And they didn't care. They didn't know how to nurture local talent and
it's really too bad.
Local programming.
There
and
was,
I, it's that
yeah.
happened to me here
yeah.
as well.
Yeah. Now, before then, in the 80s, were the late 70s, early 80s, were the halcyon days of local news. And it's when WHCU had 5 full-time people, and the Ithaca Journal was a Pulitzer Prize-winning paper,
yeah, yeah.
and WTKO did the Blood and Guts. And there was a wonderful symbiotic competitiveness going on.
Yep.
And people knew what was going on. And that, as you say, once it becomes completely commercial, you lose that that relationship.
But you were there during that heyday, right?
Yeah.
And you honed
yes.
your skills there.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
No, I just loved it.
Such a different world. It
it's
almost
a different
doesn't
world.
Seem like the same career.
I know. And it was not. By the time you were there, it wasn't.
Yeah.
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 It's so strange.
They had real reporters before
yeah,
I was
exactly.
there.
Yeah. So how long were you at HCU?
Probably just about a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't very long,
uh-huh.
yeah.
And what sparked the idea of having a talk show?
I call it an interview show instead of a talk show because people get
right.
that mixed up, mm-hmm. thinking you're talking about call-ins and mm-hmm. stuff. When I was in San Francisco, I wanted to, because of the very thing we were just talking about, things were commercial. There wasn't a lot of intimate local
right.
conversation. And so I thought, okay, let me try to do that here. I might as well. I honed a little more experience by working mm-hmm. at HCU and meeting different people and putting together stories and learning, mm-hmm. you know, quite a bit more about the business. And so I thought, okay, when I leave WHCU, and I worked for a little time at the Cornell Ithaca Partnership, I thought, okay, I want to put a show together. I really want to pursue this. I think I have an opportunity because mm-hmm. it is a small town. A lot of people knew
right.
me at that point. And so I called Tim Reppert at Rep Studio mm-hmm. and said, can I cut a demo? And that's where it began.
Yeah. I remember you're reading almost like 2 books a week sometimes because you had a prep for the authors that you were interviewing.
Yes.
And you had a nice combination of local and national and international people. What started you calling people on the phone and doing phoners?
You know, that was a scary thing for me to start in endeavoring into that because I was thinking, oh, this is just a little show, little town. Nobody's mm-hmm. going to want to be on this. But I met this publicist named Gail Leander Wright in Boston. And she said, oh, no, people want to be on radio shows. They don't care how small it is, especially since the shows live on. You know, they can share them from the websites. And,
right.
you know, so people don't
right.
think it just airs one day. They think it's something they can share that they did.
Right, exactly.
And it becomes a part of their portfolio or resume in many ways.
So it's mutually beneficial, of
it
course,
is.
For people who are trying to market a book.
And there aren't yeah. that many places. I mean, think of how many places where a writer can have a half an hour to talk about their work.
Exactly.
Really.
Exactly.
I mean, that was the thing that most struck me, that
mm-hmm.
writers were going, oh, my God,
mm-hmm.
Of course I want to come on and talk for a half an
hour.
Well,
that's interesting.
And they loved that I read the book. That
mm-hmm.
was one of my rules. I'm not going to just have people on and say, how are you?
Yeah, right.
It was a lot of work, but it was fun.
Mm-hmm. So that was your main focus, I remember. Then you broadened out into art And music to a certain extent?
Yes. I had live music in here.
You had live music in here?
Yeah. I mean, I had some people singing, Burns and Christie.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. The Burns sisters.
Yes.
A lot of people came in and sang. Joe Crookston.
Yeah. What is your connection to art that you had mentioned before?
You know,
visual art, I'm
saying. I was always interested in art as a kid. I used to try to draw. It was horrible, you know. Thank God I let go of that one. But I always loved art. We went to art museums a lot. I used to buy art books. I just loved the Dutch Renaissance paintings. And I would look at the art books and I'd check them out of the library. And it just took me to different worlds. And I was thinking, nobody's like that anymore. You know, when I was a kid, I thought, people aren't like that anymore.
It was this in your family at all?
No, okay. Not at all.
So you thought people weren't like that anymore?
No. In my neighborhood in Manhattan Beach, California, I had the pleasure of meeting a woman named Lisa, whose father was an artist. Mm. And she became my best friend. I knew the family. He was a sculptor and a painter. And I got interested in art through them in many ways, and just through people in the neighborhood. There were a lot of creative people in and around Manhattan Beach. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just thought, ooh, I like art better than the thought of having some business job. Or,
without being specific, what's the hardest type to interview, a visual artist, a musician, or a writer?
You know, I think visual artists and musicians were equally somewhat difficult. I had to learn how to take that on, because a lot of writers are used to being interviewed,
right,
been in the broadcasting world because they've been interviewed for their books. But I think musicians were probably harder than artists in some ways. But, you know, almost every artist I had on, especially early on, would tell me, I'm so scared about doing this.
Really?
I hope I don't blow it. Yeah.
Wow.
You try to tell people, don't worry about it. We're talking about your life. You obviously haven't blown it. You're a well-known, successful artist. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. But it's true. Visual artists often, I remember being so pleased being on this show with you because no one ever asked me about art.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not a topic of conversation. I think a lot of people don't know how to describe what they do or why they do it. And I think maybe some interviewers get scared by the linguistic silliness of some art reviews and resumes and so on.
Yeah.
But to me, doing anything creative is just elemental. It shouldn't be pretentious or frightening.
Yeah.
Though I do feel that way about poetry.
You do?
I do. That's what's called a graceless segue.
Speaking
of poetry, no, it's true. And I think there's a reason. At least I tell myself. I used to write poetry a lot when I was younger.
I remember you told me that. Yeah.
And then when I was a sophomore at the University of Buffalo, my poetry teacher said something cutting, sardonic, and mean.
Really?
And that was it. The moral of the story is get a thicker skin. But for me, it just put me off.
So it wasn't something that drove you, right? You know, so many poets and writers
say,
I have to write.
Yes, I know that feeling.
Even with bad reviews and so on, you know.
Right, no, for me that's painting, but not poetry, no.
Yeah.
No, I'm not a poet.
Wow,
but
that's interesting. Oh, well, whoever that was who discouraged
that's
her.
That's right, terrible.
That's bad news. You shouldn't do that to people.
But I love your poetry.
Oh,
and I always have from everything I've read. It feels human, accessible, finely wrought, but completely unpretentious, which I really love.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Have you always written poetry?
You know, I started when I was a little kid, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't doing it seriously. It was like a little kid putting pieces of paper in my drawer, not really showing them to anybody. But, yeah, I started writing when I was a kid. I started off as a teenager really, really getting into poetry. I loved Anne Sexton, Sylvia Plath. I even wrote to Anne Sexton and got a letter from her.
No.
Which I was so thrilled about.
That's thrilling, yeah.
A couple years before she
When somebody makes
suicide,
that kind of effort at that level is quite something.
And I wrote to Marge Piercy, and I got a letter from her. So all this encouraged me, because I wrote to them and told them that I was starting to write and seriously write, and that I followed their careers and admired the work that they do. And it really helped to be encouraged in that way. They didn't encourage my work.
Right.
I didn't show my
work. They just encouraged you to do it.
Just encouraged, nice to hear from you. I'm so glad, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you've got to encourage people.
Mm. Yes, I agree.
You absolutely must.
Yeah. When did you go from not writing seriously to writing seriously?
After my mother died in 1982, I started writing much more seriously. I was writing a little bit before then and trying to send stuff out, but I started honing it in and really delivering something from the heart, I think, after my mother died in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. And from there, I just kept going. It just became an addiction almost.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know if you saw it. There's a recent article in the New York Times about Judy Collins, who just turned 80.
Yes.
And it's quite an inspirational article. And at one point she says, my singing is as good as it ever was and even better because now I sing what I feel and I really mean it when I'm singing. Uh-huh. That sounds like what you just said about writing from the heart.
Yeah.
It makes a difference as opposed to filling in some sort of template or just
And, you know, not even just from the heart. I've been writing about my past and my mother and my parents and now all my health issues. Mm-hmm. But I also was writing political poems too at certain points about Take Back the Night. And I wrote a poem about the AIDS epidemic, which affected me greatly. I lost so many friends in San Francisco, especially in 1982.
Right.
So, yeah. So I was writing, you know, that's heart stuff, too, even though it's not as personal in the same way that writing about your mother's death is. But but it was personal to me. Politics always has been.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder why that is. I mean, you could say that about anyone. In other words, politics affects everyone. But to some of us, it does feel personal.
Yeah.
I think when we were talking earlier about, not on air, but before, about how we were both glued to the impeachment hearings, as if by knowing every scintilla of everything could do something about it.
Yeah.
But of course, it's an illusion. And yet, it does feel personal.
It does. Well, it affects our lives. It's part of our lives. It's how we connect in some way still with people, even if we're not just sitting there talking politics.
Right.
Politics is affecting our daily lives and our relationships. So it's a remarkable thing.
Yeah.
I got more involved in issues politics than I did in electoral.
Right.
But although I went into electoral politics too, but personal politics.
Yeah,
you know,
that's what I associate.
Trying to save our lives, the gay and lesbian politics I was involved in and the feminist politics. I mean, we have been disappeared, some of us, from this culture.
Mm-hmm.
So those things were very personal, and they still are.
Yeah.
Because we haven't won any war yet.
Right.
In regard to the way women and LGBT people and disabled people and everybody, African American people, Native American people, we're all still fighting to have
ongoing.
A voice. Yep.
What was it like when you ascended to the heights of the Tompkins County Poet Laureate?
You know, it almost felt unreal to me because I was so into the poetry already. I'd been given a lot of readings and I was well known and I'd published two collections and it almost felt like, okay, I guess this is the next step. It's supposed to be the next step, I suppose. And it was nice to be able to meet people who wouldn't generally come to my readings, you know.
Right.
Some people would come because they knew me from the radio. But it's
a good experience?
It was an incredible experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really was. And it was such a great way to get the word out about poetry, which is still undercovered, of course.
The most undercovered.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's such a beautiful language.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It is. So I was happy to be able to bring that into the community and hopefully turn on some people to the fact that it's a human language. It's good poetry.
Yeah.
It's not just the fancy, airy, rhyming stuff that people got bored with when they were kids.
Right. You alluded before to some health problems. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
My understanding is that there was always a question of the heart.
Yes.
And then it came to fruition. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, I can. When I was a little girl, I was diagnosed with aortic stenosis. I was diagnosed probably when I was 10 or so. And that was a narrowing of a heart valve. And I was in perfect health. I was fine. They didn't, you know, my doctors always said, don't run for buses, and don't lift heavy weights and stuff. But I was perfectly healthy, you know, traveling and going to school and doing all my stuff. But I was told I would always have to have heart surgery. The narrowing of the heart valve, it was the aortic valve, would get worse. It's a calcification that happens.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you get older, it's going to get worse. And, you know, I was so stupid because I was smoking for a few years in my—
For radio listeners, my jaw hit the ground.
Yes. Late teens, yep.
Wow.
And up until about—
Yeah, that is stupid, yeah.
25 or something.
Right. Oh, well, okay, so that happened. Yeah.
Lived through
All
it.
Right.
And so finally at the age of 55, which was almost 10 years ago— Was 10 years ago.
More than 10 years
ago. More than 10 years ago. I finally had to have surgery. They thought it was getting narrow enough. I wasn't really having symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it was really difficult for me to come to that idea.
Yeah.
You're kidding me. So I went into that because I knew I would have to. I had been waiting all my life for this to happen. It was so scary, though. Because, you know, once somebody says, you need heart surgery now, your heart's getting worse. I start thinking, oh, God, I'm failing, you know, and you almost start making yourself
self-fulfilling prophecy.
I feel weak and suddenly I can't breathe. And it's anxiety. It just causes such anxiety.
Sure.
But anyway, I got through it. It's a hellish experience in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost died during that little bout. But somehow I came through and I did have a good surgeon and I continued.
And you
my
wrote
life.
A lot about that experience.
I did. And I published a chapbook.
Right. Right.
The Fix Is In. I wrote tons about that. And I wrote a lot of poems right before it because I was thinking these might be my last poems before I die.
You know? That's interesting.
So a lot of the poems were written right before I went in, you know, about the morning, sitting with my cat. It was quite an experience. But, you know, I had it. It was successful. I was fine, and life went on.
And then,
out of the blue, 2 years ago, I ended up having drinks with a couple friends, listening to music, and... See, I have no memory of any of this, but I suddenly touched my chest with my hands and said, I'm having a hard time breathing or something like that. And I went to the bathroom, and I thought, okay. Came back out. That's when I had a heart attack, massive heart attack.
Wow.
And they still don't know what caused it. They think it was probably a blood clot. Because my heart surgery was successful. I asked them that.
Right.
And they said, no, you're not prone to having a heart attack after this. No, no more than anyone else.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, massive heart attack. I can't tell you how shocked I was, because I was still so out of it for months when I woke up and my partner said, you had a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what? No!
Yeah. I remember seeing you in the hospital and you had no idea I was there.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I had no idea of the first few months. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. God, what a horrible experience this was. Really, I felt totally separated from my life, totally separated from this community. And, you know, I have that Health Challenges series that I have on my show.
Yes.
And a lot of people talked about how isolated they thought they became and did become, how afraid people were of you when you had a disease and they knew about it.
That series is
and
a gift.
I was thinking... That was how I felt after my heart attack.
Right.
I was thinking people are going to be afraid to see me. They're going to think I'm different.
And so you kept writing. You don't have any poems about your heart situation, do you?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Do you have one you could read on the air right now?
I've got a book that's coming up. Now that I've had the heart attack and know all about it and came back, the poems I was writing before the heart attack seemed to me it was some kind of a premonition in some ways.
That's interesting.
This is one that I wrote right after the heart attack.
Can you read it?
Yeah. It's called At Long Last. I only ask that the hand be revealed. I want to see what the universe will look like when I am banished from the hourly command to be here now. I want to know if I'll still sense the fog over the coast of California. Will it be a flash in the dark, or will I take all my memories to an energy beyond? I can't imagine abandoning the sacred mornings on the shoreline, or the twilight cry of gulls at low tide, or spring bird song. Will you remember me? Will you remember me? Will that heartbreaking blue sky, where one lone gull glides the steady winds, soaring, soaring, soaring into dissolve, will it carry me?
That's lovely, Tish. Yes, you will be remembered. I think what you've brought to this community with this show over the last 15 years has been really irreplaceable.
Yeah.
And to coin a phrase, we had a lot to talk about.
Yes, absolutely. And it's been an incredible experience.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way anybody gets that gift of meeting so many creative, thoughtful, forward-thinking people in one lifetime.
Yep.
So I feel really blessed.
And luckily, everything is up on the website, which will continue. So if you've missed any interviews over the years, you can always go.
All almost 700 of them are up.
Wow.
OutofBoundsRadioShow.com.
There you go.
Yes, and they're all there. Even people who are dead are there.
Well, all the more reason to check.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you very much, Tish Perlman.
Thank you, Barbara Mink.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.